We were discussing the role of archaeology in assessing historical statements of the Bible. And I wanted to emphasize two things. One, archaeological evidence is in many cases tentative as far as the interpretation of the evidence is concerned. Actually, that was the second thing. And the first thing was the fragmentary character of the results of archaeological findings. We're in the middle of that discussion of the tentative nature of interpretation of archaeological data, and I had just introduced to you the question of Solomon's copper mines in the area by Heatsy and Geber, and the study of the evidence of that by Nelson Gluck. He was looking for Solomon's seaport at Heatsy and Geber, which is mentioned in 1 Kings 9:26. King Solomon made a navy of ships in Heatsy and Geber. Didn't find any evidence for that, but he found this evidence of copper smelting. And he came on a building which he concluded was a smelting furnace or a refinery. The features of the building were that there were rooms that had two rows in the walls of holes in the walls. And he concluded that those holes were flues in which a draft was drawn into the room to smelt the copper ore. The location of the building was such that it received the force of the winds that came down the Araba Valley from the north. And so the building could have been moved a bit one way or a bit the other way and it would have had more protection. It wouldn't have received the full force of these winds. So he concluded it was put there in order to gather this wind and direct it into these flues for smelting of copper ore. So he said this was the first blast furnace in history, in the area of Heatsy and Geber. On your bibliography page 11, you have two articles there by Nelson Gluck. The first one is the second campaign at Tel El Khalifa, Heatsy and Geber, Alaska, in 1939. It was written in the Bulletin of the American Society of Oriental Research. Here's what he said in that article. He said, Heatsy and Geber was the result of careful planning and was built as a model installation with remarkable architectural and technical skill. In fact, practically, the whole town of Heatsy and Geber, taking into consideration place and time, was a phenomenal industrial site without anything to compare with it in the entire history of the ancient Orient. Heatsy and Geber was the Pittsburgh of old Palestine, and at the same time, its most important seaport. So he found this building, drew that conclusion. That conclusion then was adopted in many of the handbooks on biblical archaeology, confirming Solomon's trading activity centered at Heatsy and Geber. Question?
Could you show us the Heatsy and Geber on the map?
Right here at the tip of the Gulf of Aqaba, right there. You see, it's quite a ways from Jerusalem, across the desert. But the trading undoubtedly went to the east, through the Red Sea, and further to the east. So it was thought that this threw light on 1 Kings 9:26. Where it says Solomon made this navy of ships in Heatsy and Geber, and the trade must have been trade in copper, where he took copper to the east, and then he brought back, if you look at chapter 10 of 1 Kings, verse 21, King Solomon's drinking vessels were of gold, and all the vessels of the house of the forest of Lebanon were of pure gold. None were of silver, which was not considered as anything in the days of Solomon, for the king had at sea, a navy of Tarshish with the navy of Hiram. Once in 3 years came the navy of Tarshish, bringing gold and silver and ivory and apes and peacocks. So Solomon exceeded all the kings of the earth in riches and wisdom. Apparently he was trading the copper for many of these other things. Well, that may still be the case, that it was a copper trade that was involved at Ezion Geber. But what has changed is that Gluck's original interpretation of the use of that building, he later completely modified. In an article, the second article here, written in 1965, Ezion Geber in the Biblical Archaeologist, he says he and others now think that the holes in the wall of this building are merely the result of decay or burning of wooden beams. And they were put there to set the beam in the wall. And he says that kind of construction has been found in numerous other places. So that comparing that building with other buildings that have come to light, the conclusion is quite different. The copper smelting, he feels, was done in quite a different manner in small crucibles heated on charcoal fires that just produced small buttons of copper. So it was a rather primitive method. There was copper that was produced there, and he still feels in the time of Solomon, but nothing like this blast furnace idea that he originally proposed. More recently still, a man named Benno Rothenberg, it's the entry at the bottom of page 11, in 1972, he wrote this book, Timna, Valley of the Biblical Copper Mines. He concludes on the basis of excavations in the same area that mining activity was restricted to the 14th to 12th centuries BC. Now, if you reflect on that for a minute, that means Solomon wasn't involved in copper trading at all, because 14th to 12th centuries would be more of a Mosaic era, not the time of Solomon. Rothenberg says there is no evidence whatsoever of any copper mining and smelting activities in the Western Arabia later than the 12th century BC until the renewal of the industry in the Roman period. So from the 12th century to the Roman period, he says there was no activity in copper smelting in that area. However, if you look at J. Bimson's article, that's about the middle of page 11, King Solomon's Mines, ? A reassessment of the finds in the Araba, Tyndale Bulletin, 1981. Bimson interacts with Rothenberg's material. And in that article that's listed there, he makes a case for his own conclusion, and I'll quote him. He says, the attribution of mining and smelting activity in the Araba to Solomon's time has been dismissed too readily. In the reassessment of the history of mining in the Araba, which the radiocarbon dates now demand, Solomonic activity contends most strongly for a place. Now, I'm not going to try to settle the question whether Solomon was engaged in copper smelting or wasn't. It gets to be a very technical kind of discussion. What I'm trying to illustrate here is this question of the tentative nature of the interpretation of archaeological data. You get Gluck coming on strong and then changing his position, and then Rothenberg comes in with a totally different position. Benson comes in with one that restores the idea that Solomon was there. And there's just a lot of room for debate as to how to understand what the evidence is. And that's often the case with archaeological findings. So I think those two things help to provide a perspective. The fragmentary nature of the evidence, number one, so we don't conclude something is suspect simply because it's not corroborated. And secondly, the tentative nature of the interpretation of the evidence, in many cases, depends on the nature of the evidence. But in something like a building with holes in the walls, you're making conjectures. And with that kind of evidence, you have to be very careful. Archaeological research, like any other human endeavor, is subject to error. Archaeologists can make mistakes. Question? I don't think it was under pressure. I think that the kind of structure that was there, at least from my understanding of the evidence, was found to exist in other places. And so that he thought it was a unique kind of structure initially, and it proved not to be. So that really was a key in his whole theory. I don't think it was just pressure from other people in that instance. You have to, you know, there could be that, particularly with people with a bias against biblical trustworthiness and so forth.
Well, that was just a question I got from the Grace article.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Let's see, was that just about the time that Gluck's second article came out? 65, right about that time. From what I've read, there seems to be general agreement that that building was not a smelting furnace. So. He's in Gaber?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Same place?
Same place. There's a point of land of Israeli-held territory that comes into that northernmost part of the Gulf of Aden, but there's also a section in Egypt and a section of Jordan that comes in there. They all come in there right together, and you can, within a matter of, a mile or so, probably at the most, be in each of those three countries. No, that's important. I think you're right. Yeah, you're right. Well, to get back to this whole thing of perspective on using archaeology, I think we should appreciate and utilize the light that archaeology throws on Scripture, because it's done much to illuminate the Scripture. We understand the cultural background to the Old Testament much better today than before the findings of archaeological research. And there's a lot of value, and we should appreciate that and utilize it. But we need to keep in mind its incompleteness and the tentative nature of many of its findings, and be careful in the way in which we say either the Bible proves or disproves the Bible. Either one. Questions or comments on that? Let's go on to 5 then. Roman 5. Yes.
One question. Would you highly recommend reading journals on the biblical archaeological review?
Yes.
There are several publications. Which ones?
Well, yeah. Biblical Archaeology Review. In fact, I think I have a copy of that right here. No, I must have left it up on my desk. No, here it is. I don't know. Are you familiar with that? This is the Bible Review. I'm sorry. Biblical Archaeological Review is published by the same people who published this. They came out with that Biblical Archaeological Review, and it was quite successful because it's a very attractive publication. It has diagrams, four-color pictures, a popular kind of text, and it treats interesting subjects, but not too often from a very conservative perspective. That's the problem with it. But there's it's an enormous source of information, what's going on archaeologically in the Near East. So I think it is a good thing to read. Now, I think they had a good thing going, so they came out with this, the Bible Review, which is not just archaeology. It just has to do with discussion of biblical interpretation, history, etc., generally, and even theology. Again, the slant is quite liberal. But it's done in an attractive, very readable kind of way, and apparently it's gaining a good audience. The Biblical Archaeology Review is a newer publication as compared to the Biblical Archaeologist. The Biblical Archaeologist goes way back. It, for years, was the standard on biblical archaeology, but it was a more technical thing. Its format was not so attractive. It used to be published, without many pictures and black and white. And for the average layperson, it's not something they'd pick up and read. When the Biblical Archaeology Review started coming out, it about wiped out biblical archaeologists until they revamp their style, and they've come up with a style that's much more like the Biblical Archaeology Review, although still not quite as popular. It's more technical. But those two are certainly worthwhile magazines, the Biblical Archaeologist and the Biblical Archaeology Review. This one as well, something to keep your eye on. They're interesting articles. I had this in my briefcase because this article, Biblical Maps, How Reliable Are They?, sort of relates to what we're discussing in a way. It gets back to the site identification. You read in the Bible that such and such happened in a certain place, and that place has gone out of existence, and you know there are a bunch of tells, the mounds. And then the question is, which mound do you identify with that biblical site? And how do you go about doing that? And this article points out that there's a lot of tentative conclusions in that area as to site identification. And we're going to discuss this later when we get to Joshua, and particularly the site of Ai, that says when Joshua went up there, you know, with the Achan thing, the Israelites were defeated. And then initially they took Ai. But the archaeologists who have excavated that mound say it wasn't occupied during the time of Joshua. And that the whole story of the conquest of Ai is confused and probably is a story about the conquest of Bethel, because Bethel was occupied then, Ai wasn't, according to the archaeologists. Well, we'll discuss this in more detail later. I'm inclined to think it's a case of mistaken site identification. And the place that they are assuming is Ai is not Ai. And there have been proposals for alternate sites. But in this article on biblical maps, I'm going kind of far afield here, but again, on this tentative nature of archaeological findings, this fella discusses the site of Tel Hesbon, and he says Hesbon is mentioned in Numbers, and archaeological work there have shown that Tel Hesbon poses a dilemma for those who take the biblical account of the conquest essentially face value and date the conquest in the late Bronze Age. Because the archaeology doesn't conform with that. And then he comments, but scholars who have taken seriously the results of literary critical studies of Numbers, 21 to 30, over the past century, were not at all surprised with the archaeological findings of Tel Hesbon. While literary critics have not always agreed on details, they've almost unanimously concluded that the narrative portion of Numbers 21 belongs to a late, largely editorial stratum of the Pentateuch. And that the poem quoted in that section belongs to an earlier Israelite conquest of the Transjordan kingdom. In other words, literary analysis of the passage had already raised doubts regarding its reliability for historical reconstruction. The archaeological excavation simply confirmed those doubts. Now, you see, you get into the dual problem here of literary critical analysis combined with archaeological analysis, both of them being negative in this case. But then his next paragraph, what interests me, because he says it is true that literary analysis requires some degree of subjective judgment. And admittedly, it is disconcerting when different literary critics working with the same text reach different conclusions, as often happens. And it does. I mean, you don't have to read far in the literature to find that. But then he says, I'm not at all convinced that analyzing an ancient text with the methods of source, form, historical, and traditional criticism is any more or less subjective than excavating a 15-foot square on a tell. Both tasks involve carefully worked out procedures designed to ensure objectivity, yet both require judgmental decisions at almost every step of the way. In other words, you see, the point is, whether you're doing literary criticism or archaeological work, those judgments at every step involve the subjective element, and you can't get away from it. He says, were it possible for different archaeological teams to re-excavate the same section of a tell again and again over a period of a century, and if the director did not always have the final word in the excavation reports, I suspect that the pattern of general agreement would be about the same as it has been with literary critical research in the Bible over the past century. In other words, every time you do it, you're going to come up with a different conclusion. Depends on who the director it is. Depends on how you make those judgments as you go along the way. So, I thought that was an interesting...
It's almost the problem you have with the smelter facility. It's almost like the guy was looking for a smelting facility. He had that impression, and so I think he found it was an amazing thing.
With academic work, that principle is hard to exclude. You come to something looking for something, and because you're looking for something, that organizes the way you look at the thing and what your conclusions are, what the evidence is, and how you fit things together. And it's something you always have to struggle with. You have to struggle with it in your theology, you know, in putting the scripture together. You can prove, you know, you come looking for proof for this or that or the other thing. You're going to find it. Let's go on to the patriarchal period. Genesis 11:27 to Genesis 50. This is a new major section. First, let me just comment on the dividing point. At Genesis 11:27, you have that statement we talked about earlier. Now these are the generations of. And here it's, now these are the generations of Terah. And that phrase, these are generations of, as we mentioned, occurs 10 times through the book of Genesis. It's a major dividing point. Now, it occurs to begin this new section. What we're interested in and what follows is not so much about Terah, it's about what comes forth out of Terah, it's about Abraham. So, you come to the narrowing down at this point of biblical history. Because prior to 11:27, we've had a history of all mankind. You start with Adam, you move up to the flood and Noah, and you start over again. And out of the three sons of Noah, the whole earth was populated. But from this point on, we have the history of a particular family that has been chosen by God to be given His revelation and through whom to carry on His work of revelation and redemption. So that the universal period here gives way for the particularistic. It's narrowed down. I think that's Voss's term. I'm not sure of that. But the universal period gives way to the particularistic period. It's the third time, really, that God begins with a family. Because He did it with Adam, He did it with Noah. And now, out of all the families, He selects Abraham. All right, A is historical background. I'm not going to discuss that. You've read Finnegan on the historical background for Mesopotamia, Egypt, and Palestine for this period. Schultz has a summary in pages 19 to 27 in his book. So I will leave that particular material for your reading of Finnegan and Schultz. But I do want to discuss B, the authenticity of the patriarchal accounts. In the early part of this century, in critical circles, the patriarchs were considered really just legendary personalities or personifications of tribes, not really individuals. Certainly not historical persons. And that's the result of Wellhausen's approach and the people that followed him. There's been somewhat of a reversal in that kind of negative attitude. There's more confidence today, generally, in historicity of the patriarchal narratives than there was in the early part of this century. Just compare these two statements. And I take one from Wellhausen himself, which is page 12. About two-thirds of the way down the page, page 318 and 19 of his Prolegomena, to the history of ancient Israel, where he says, we attain to know historical knowledge of the patriarchs, but only to the time when the stories about them arose in the Israelite people. We don't learn anything about the patriarchal time. We learn something about the time when P was in the exile, or the time when J and E were, 800, 900, 700. He says this later age is unconsciously projected in its inner and its outward features into hoar antiquity and is reflected there like a glorified mirage. He says we learn nothing of historical value about the patriarchal times from the patriarchal narratives. Because the material is also late and it tells us something about the time which it was written, not something about the time that it represents itself to be speaking about. Contrast that kind of an attitude with John Bright, who has written a volume that's probably as standard a history of Israel as there is used in mainline denominational seminaries. History of Israel, third edition by John Bright. He was professor of Old Testament at Union Theological Seminary in Virginia, the Southern Presbyterian Seminary in Richmond. You can read this book with a lot of profit. He is a student of Albright's. He's not an evangelical scholar, but he's much more conservative in his attitudes than certainly than German scholars are generally, and certainly much more so than Wellhaus. So that when he comes to this question of the patriarchs, on page 92 of his third edition, he says, the evidence so far adduced gives us every right to affirm that the patriarchal narratives are firmly based in history. But must we stop there? Must we regard the patriarchs as but the reflection of impersonal clan movements? Not at all. Although we cannot undertake to reconstruct the lives of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, we may confidently believe that they were actual historical individuals. Now, he's not going to say that the patriarchal accounts are totally reliable historically, but he does come a long way from Wellhausen and say we can confidently assert they were historical individuals. Now, that more positive attitude has been widespread, particularly in this country, even among critical scholars, for the last 25 years or so. But interestingly enough, in quite recent times, it's been challenged again. In other words, there have been those that want to turn the clock back to the old Wellhausen kind of position. On your bibliography, there are two volumes there. You should at least know the names of these people. T.L. Thompson, The Historicity of the Patriarchal Narratives, published in New York and Berlin in 1974. And J. Van Cedars, Abraham and History and Tradition, Yale University Press, 1975. Now, those two books were written independently and from somewhat different perspectives, but both of them, in essence, challenged this more positive attitude towards historicity of the patriarchs. Both those books. And they're major books. Thompson argues that Albright's evidence for historicity of the patriarchal narratives is based largely on circumstantial evidence, and it's not convincing to him. On page 328 of his volume, Thompson says, salvation history did not happen. It is a literary form which has its own historical context. The Bible does not speak of a historical Abraham. Those are radical statements. Journals, you can read the reviews of books like this. It's a good thing to do. You'll find that generally there was a rather positive response to his book. In the Journal of Biblical Literature, which is the standard journal of American scholarly circles in biblical studies, it's the Journal of the Society of Biblical Literature, the reviewer, who was a Jewish scholar, said the purpose of the book is to review the central arguments that are held by biblical scholars in favor of the historicity of the patriarchs in Genesis. In my opinion, Thompson's review is tantamount to a complete refutation of these arguments. So in other words, all this gain, you might say, through Albright and Bright and people like that of having more positive things, Thompson comes and attacks the evidence on which that is based. And someone like Matthew Safat, that's the way his name is pronounced, a Jewish scholar, says it's tantamount to a refutation of those arguments. Turns the clock back really to the skepticism of the earlier position. In the standard journal in England, the Journal of Theological Studies, which is published, I'm not sure whether it's Oxford or Cambridge, one of the two, J.A. Emerton says, he has not proved that the patriarchs did not exist, but he has shown that the substantial historicity of the traditions about them has been accepted too easily by many scholars. It is possible that Thompson's work will introduce a new stage in the study of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Well, I think you have to be aware. There's a new challenge. I think the jury's still out as to which way things are going to move. Are people going to follow Thompson, Van Cedars, back toward a much more skeptical position, or are things going to remain more in the line of the Albright and maybe even, hopefully, with evangelical influence, even more positive attitude than that? I don't know. I think it remains to be seen. There is, just for your own information, a volume of essays on this whole issue written by evangelical scholars, and that's the one on your sheet, Millard and Wiseman, editors. Essays on the Patriarchal Narratives, Winona Lake Eisenbrown's 1983. That's quite recent. And there are a lot of good articles in that book, which interact with Cedars and Kale Thompson. So there's a lot of discussion going on right now. I might just say as an aside on T.L. Thompson. See, that book was published in, what, 74? Must have been about 1975. I was in here one evening up in the library, and a student came to me and said he'd just been talking with somebody in another part of the library who had studied in Tübingen, Old Testament, and thought I'd go meet the fellow, so I did, and went and talked with him a bit. And we had an interesting conversation, but I found his name was T.L. Thompson, which at that point, the book had just been published. I didn't know who he was. The name didn't mean anything to me. He had just come into this area from studying in Germany, and this book was his dissertation in Germany. And his wife had a position at Temple University, and they were living in a trailer park here in Hatfield. It's interesting. And I was going to say something else about it. Well, in any case, at that point, T.L. Thompson's name didn't mean a thing to me. About a year, maybe it wasn't even that long later, maybe it was a month or so later, I became aware of his book. And then, you know, later night, even reviews started coming out of the book, and realized who this fellow was, because he really did write a significant and important book, whether you agree with it or not. But he was using our library for his own research there for a while. I think he and his wife both, I think, teach now at the University of North Carolina or somewhere like that. They weren't in this area very long. Yes? Abraham and History and Tradition. It's about two-thirds of the way down on page 12. Yeah. That's right. That's T.L. Thompson. That's right. That's right. Well, get back to where I started. There has been a reversal, with the exception of this attempt to turn the clock back by Thompson Van Cedars. Generally, there's been this reversal, and that reversal toward a more positive attitude toward historicity of the patriarchs is really due to archaeological research. Because, you know, there's just been thousands of texts that have been discovered that date at approximately the same time as patriarchal narratives. And they've thrown a lot of light on the period. Let me just, with respect to those texts, sort of review for you the major collections. that comes. Can you see that? The major bodies of texts are first the Mari text, about the 18th century B.C. Finnegan discusses them on pages 56 and 57. The city of Mari, right here, it's on the Euphrates River, a bit north of Babylon. It was excavated shortly before World War II by the French, and the city was a major power of its time at about 1700 B.C. Now, patriarchal period, Abraham's about 2000. You go right down for a couple hundred years after that, approximately the same time then as Jacob probably. So, it was a major power of its day. It fell to Hammurabi of Babylon. Babylon conquered Mari. About 20,000 tablets were found in the palace. And among them, you have texts that have correspondence between Hammurabi and Zimri-Lim. Zimri-Lim was the king of Mari. You also have texts on the techniques of divination. One of their techniques was to examine the livers and entrails of sacrificial animals. And depending on the configuration of the entrails or the shape of the liver, that kind of thing, it had a certain meaning or significance. There are a number of mentions of the city of Nahor, which was the home of Rebekah in the patriarchal narratives. Nahor, over in the Mesopotamian area. So you have that group of texts. Then you have the Cappadocian texts, which are found in Asia Minor, in the eastern part of Asia Minor. I don't think the place is called Tepe. I don't see it on this map. It's over in this area of present-day Turkey. They date from the 19th century B.C. They come from colonies of Assyrian merchants who were carrying on a trade with the people of Asia Minor. And they had settlements on the outsides of the towns there. And the texts come from those Assyrian merchants. The third group is the Nuzi texts. They are a bit later, 15th century B.C. They reflect the customs of the Hurrian population around the area of Nuzi, which is in the East Tigris area. Right here. Nuzi. In about the 15th century. You read in Finnegan, pages 65, 67 of these Nuzi texts. They include discussion of such things as slave adoption laws, marriage contracts, inheritance rights, customs of that sort, which correspond rather closely to similar customs that are reflected in patriarchal narratives. Fourth is the Rashamra text, 15th, 14th centuries. Finnegan 171 to 174. They were discovered in 1929 on the coast of Syria, present-day Lebanon, a place called by the name of Ugarit. They are written in a cuneiform script. Cuneiform is where you have that stylus that's pressed into clay and you get these, and just get these markings. The end of the stylus of the clay. They're written in a cuneiform script, but it's a Semitic language. And the language was unknown before these texts were discovered in 1929. When it was deciphered, it was found to be a Semitic language rather closely related to Biblical Hebrew. So that the study of Ugaritic became a new study And the linguistic studies of some of these texts in Ugaritic has thrown light on certain grammatical features as well as vocabulary problems in Hebrew, because they are related languages. The fifth group is the execration texts, which come from the 20th and 19th centuries B.C. I have 10th there, it should be 20th. 20th and 19th centuries B.C., which illustrate how Pharaoh in Egypt, they come out of Egypt, sought to bring magical power to bear on his enemies. And the way in which that was done was that imprecations, curses, would be inscribed on bowls, and then the bowls would be smashed. Sometimes those imprecations were written on clay figurines of bound captives. But in those inscriptions, there are a lot of places mentioned up in the land of Canaan that give an idea of the extent of Egyptian sphere of influence up into the land of Canaan, 20th, 19th centuries B.C. And then sixth, the Ebla texts, about the 24th century B.C., you want to read something about Ebla. I don't have this on the bibliography, but K.A. Kitchen has a book, The Bible in Its World, The Bible and Archaeology Today, by K.A. Kitchen. There's a chapter on Ebla. Now, Ebla, of course, is something that's rather recent, and there's not a whole lot that can be said about it because very little, if anything, has been published from the Ebla text as yet. But let me just tell you a little bit about them. They were found at a place called Tel Mardik, M-A-R-D-I-K-H, which is to the north and west of Beirut, present-day Syria. The mound that was excavated there was identified as Ebla in 1968. There's a mound that had been there, of course, for centuries. Nobody knew exactly what it was. It was identified in 1968 as a place called Ebla. And in 1975, 17,000 cuneiform tablets were found in the ruin of a palace. It was determined that that palace was destroyed at about 2250 BC. This would be before the patriarchal period, about a century. Now, some have said that this is the greatest archaeological find of the century. And there have been a lot of superlative things said about the significance and importance of the Ebla tablets. The tablets reveal an empire that dominated much of the Middle East in that time, about 24th century BC, that was previously unknown. It was a major empire. Among the texts, cities and personal names that are found in the Bible appear on the tablets, including places like Sodom and Gomorrah and names like Eber and Abraham. Now, not that the Abraham there is the same as the Abraham in the Bible, but the name of the individual, Abraham, does occur. Besides administrative texts, governmental kinds of things, it is said that there are literary texts, including myths of creation and the flood, hymns and treaty texts, and all sorts of material like that. None of it's been published. And access to it is very limited. And the people who have access are very concerned that they don't get the Syrian government turned against them if there's too much biblical connection to the Jewish antecedents that's involved in the study of these things. So they're not saying much. And it's hard to know when that may change. It may take a long time. The people with access to the text seem to presently be downplaying the relation of the text to the Old Testament, probably for political reasons. But, just by way of conclusion, from this body of material, see, there's a lot of material. it has become apparent that patriarchal customs, as described in Genesis, are close to those reflected in the text of the second millennium BC. The way people went about them, as reflected in the patriarchal narratives, fits in the time which these texts tell us of. And secondly, this might even be more important, early Hebrew names fit in a class of names known to have been current in Mesopotamian Palestine in the second millennium BC, and particularly the early part of that. Now on that, let me read to you from Bright, his history, page 77 and 78. The names in the patriarchal narratives fit perfectly in a class known to have been current in both Mesopotamia and Palestine the second millennium. For example, of the names of the patriarchs themselves, Jacob occurs in an 18th century text from Upper Mesopotamia. The name Abram is known from the Babylonian text, the First Dynasty, possibly from the Execration text. Although the name Isaac is not instanced, and Joseph, not apparently so, both are of a thoroughly characteristic early type. Further, Nahor occurs in the Mari text. Terah and Serug occur, the names of the sons of Jacob. Benjamin appears in the Mari text. The name Zebulun occurs in the Execration text. Gad and Dan are known from Mari. Ishmael, perhaps Levi, occur at Mari. Asher and Issachar are found in 18th century Egyptian lists. And then he says, to this must be added the Ebla text, where, so we are told, numerous personal names familiar to us from the Bible are found. Abram, Eber, Ishmael, Esau, Saul, David, Israel, as well as others. Now, he concludes, to be sure, in none of these cases do we even probably have the mention of a biblical patriarch. But the profusion of such names in contemporary texts shows clearly that Upper Mesopotamia and Northern Syria did in fact contain a population akin to Israel's ancestors in the Middle Bronze Age and centuries before. This both reinforces confidence in the antiquity of the tradition and adds verisimilitude to the Bible's assertion that Israel's ancestors had migrated from this general area. But then the significant statement is the names are of an early type. They certainly are not characteristic of later Israelite nomenclature. In other words, later Israelite nomenclature, this stuff was written in the exile, is different. He says, none of the names of the patriarchs themselves, and very few of the names of those concerned with them, ever occur as proper names in Israel again throughout the biblical period. I mean, you don't run across Abraham's later on in Scripture. So he says the patriarchal narratives in this respect are most authentic. So it's that kind, you see, McCrae talked about the direct and the indirect kind of corroboration. This is indirect. Not direct. But in that general kind of way, the patriarchal narratives fit in the time in which they represent themselves to be. Left stuff. Thank you.